everyone. Welcome to the Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield's Community Radio. My name is Donna Todd Rivers, and I'll be with you for about the next 58 minutes. If you cannot stay for the whole show, I think you're going to want to hear the whole show. So my suggestion is to make sure you look onto pittsfieldtv.org, and all the shows are listed there. So if you miss something or we want to hear it, you can see the entire show there as well. I'm pretty excited about this show today. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time. I am sitting with Jesse Kowalski. He's the chief curator at the Berkshire Museum. And of course, if you're from Pittsfield, the Berkshire Museum means a great deal to all of us. It was a big part of my growing up. And to be honest with you, it is one of the reasons that I went into cultural anthropology as my major in college, was because of my great experiences as a young girl running through that museum and going to school field trips there. So it has this really, and plus I was a Ward 5 city councilor. It was in my ward. So it really has a very strong place in my heart. So I invited Jesse on to talk a little bit about what he does. And then of course, to let you know what's currently happening at the museum. So hello, Jesse, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to talk to you. I always find what your work is so fascinating. So I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit about how'd you become a museum curator? How does that, I mean, I don't remember that being listed in all the occupations when I was a kid to pick.
Yeah, no, I had no idea what a museum curator really did. I went to school for marine biology and didn't get along so well with the marine biology teacher, I guess, but I took some art history classes and just fell in love with the art history teacher. She was such a great mentor, and I just became more and more involved in art history and more interested, especially in abstract expressionism and contemporary art. And from there, I sent out some internship applications. One of which was to the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That was in 96, and they had just opened in 1994. So they accepted me for an internship that fall. I worked there for about 2.5 months on different exhibits, and then went home for Christmas break. And when I was home, they called me and asked if I wanted to work there. Full-time, preparing the first major exhibition to travel. And I still had another semester of school left, but I was able to work it out so that I could finish my schooling while working at the Andy Warhol Museum. And so that's how it started.
That's pretty amazing, actually. Well, I'm kind of glad for that marine biology teacher. I bet you are, too. Right?
Yeah.
I can totally appreciate the power of teachers in shaping our paths for sure. Yeah. And also the nice thing about it is, you know, people say, oh, you know, you can't major in art or art history, there's no jobs. And yeah. Here you are having an incredible career, even coming right out of school. I mean, that's a pretty amazing place to start.
Yeah. You know, it's, I don't know. I guess it's a little bit of luck, a little bit of skill, but yeah, I got a great in the right place at the right time, I guess. But it was really a wonderful learning experience. So I ended up staying at the Andy Warhol Museum for 18 years.
Wow.
I met my wife there did a lot of traveling for the exhibitions because Warhol's so popular around the world. So I got to travel all around the world. They actually, I was the biggest guy there. So they sent me to the worst places. So the most dangerous places, I suppose. So I had to go to like Kazakhstan and over to China, Azerbaijan.
Wow.
Yeah, some, yeah,
and pretty interesting.
Russia. And so it was quite an experience, and there's a lot of great stories. I actually just shared a photograph with my kids that I hadn't shown them before of me standing with the security guards in Kazakhstan. They're holding machine guns, and they let me hold one.
Wow, that, you know, really, what an experience you've had, right, with that art history major. I just want everyone to hear that loud and clear. I'm a big proponent of the arts, and it's nice to hear, yes, you can have a career, and you can have a great career in the arts. So how did you land in Pittsfield? That's always fascinating, how people get here.
Yeah, well, I had done several exhibits at the Andy Warhol Museum, and I had been working on an exhibition of the work of the comic book artist Alex Ross, who was heavily influenced by Norman Rockwell. And so I came to the Norman Rockwell Museum around 2010, I think, and did some research on Rockwell for the exhibit and borrowed some artworks from them, and had the Alex Ross exhibition at the Andy Warhol Museum. It ended up being the most popular exhibition to date at the Andy Warhol Museum, which really shocked me. But at the opening, we had lines around the corner and everything, and it was really something else because I think comic book art really hadn't been looked at as one of the finer arts. And the Norman Rockwell Museum took the exhibition, and it was very successful for them, and it traveled to a couple other venues. And then the curator and I have been in touch about working on an exhibition together on Warhol, Rockwell, and Disney. And then a opening for a curator of exhibitions opened at the Rockwell Museum, and so I applied, and they hired me for that. And so got the
Lucky,
family
lucky
up, and
us. Lucky us in the Berkshires.
yeah, so we moved up here in 2015. And I was at the Norman Rockwell Museum for 8 years. Did some fun shows. I did the Hanna-Barbera exhibition.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
I
that was a lot
remember
of fun.
that.
And Tony Dietrich-Lietze's exhibition was great. Did this big fantasy illustration show a couple of years ago that was pretty popular. And then the position here at the Berkshire Museum opened up for a chief curator, and it seemed like like a good challenge for me. And I had kind of done all the exhibits, I guess, that I wanted to do at the Rockwell Museum, and the Berkshire Museum had been through some hard times, and it seemed like a great place to really come into and try to really sprinkle some pixie dust and see what I could do, I guess.
Well, I think you can. I mean, the one thing about the Berkshire Museum, of course, is its collection, its own collection, is really eclectic. I mean, and that goes back to Crane and kind of what his vision of the museum was. What I think it was 1903, maybe? Was it 1903?
Three, yeah.
Yeah. And the museum, of course, is what? Art, natural history, and ancient civilization. At least that's its basic premise. So it does give you a lot of things to work with. So how do you decide on the themes of your upcoming exhibits with all of that to work with?
So the main themes of the museum, it's art, history, and science. And so I try to combine all three into each exhibit, which is a little difficult sometimes. But for example, we're doing an illuminated manuscripts exhibition right now. So that combines the art and the history, and then the science and how they did the manuscripts. So trying to do shows like that that are educational but also entertaining. And it seems like that one's kind of popular. We did the Hudson River School show last summer that was very popular,
People.
and got some exciting shows coming up. This summer, I'm working with an artist I worked with before, Julie Bell. She's mostly known for her fantasy work, but she's been working on wildlife paintings lately, so I'll be showing a lot of her wildlife art for the first time.
That would be awesome. So how do you pick? I mean, do you have a list in your mind of all these exhibits that you might want to do? Or I mean, how does that come to be? Or do you sort of walk through the museum or down in the basement and pull something out and go, oh, this is kind of interesting. Like, how does that kind of work?
Yeah, I always have a running list of like 50 ideas. Most of them are terrible, but some are good. And so trying to figure out what can go into each one, and which ones would be popular with the public, which ones are worth exhibiting, I guess, and not too expensive, and
Well, that's true.
work on those. And yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. The collection here is just nuts. I think it's going to take me a few years to get acclimated to everything in the collection.
Well, yeah, how do you go about doing that? Because I know some things end up in the main exhibits and then other things sort of are cataloged or stored. And so, how do you know? I mean, how do you know what's in that museum?
It's really our collections manager,
Okay.
Jason DeVore. He's really the brains behind the collection, and so we do have a database. But really, if I have any questions about the collection, I go right to him, and I'll say, what do we have in the form of ancient writing or whatever, and he'll show me a few cuneiform tablets or something, and I'll ask him, do we have any unique swords or anything. And he found this one sword that has a gun with one bullet that you can load into it
Well,
on
that's
the
interesting.
helm.
Yeah.
That was from the Vatican, actually. So I just ask him these questions, and he pulls out these most amazing objects.
Really, I think, I mean, some of those things probably haven't been seen in a really long time, too, because don't you
Right.
search? There's only so much space there, and you can only
Yeah.
circulate so much of the collection. So, how do you make a decision about what's out and display and what stays? And I mean, that's, I know there's some things that are there all the time, like the minerals. Everybody knows about the minerals. And the diagrams.
So the diorama room, that
Yep.
everybody loves that one. So that one's pretty much stayed the same for a while, and don't have any plans to change it because people love it the way it is. We are doing a renovation, the third of three renovations the museum is doing, and we'll be working on the first floor of the museum, so replacing a lot of the windows, adding insulation, extra lighting and security, and updates to the floor plan. And part of that, I'm going to change around the first floor a little bit. So the lobby will be much more contemporary. The first gallery you walk into will be a new theater, black box space where we can have conferences or music or lectures or whatever. And then the next gallery, that's known as the Hall of Taxidermy, it's going to change quite a bit. It'll be based on Zenas Crane's original idea of these cabinets of curiosities. They were started in Germany in the 1500s. It was really the first kind of museums in which these rich collectors, since exploration around the world had just started, they sent people around the world to find different objects, and they would bring them back to their homes or museums and organize them by themes in these cabinets. And so that was Zenas Crane's idea, and it's kind of the idea of the Smithsonian, I suppose. And so we're going to have the different cabinets that are arranged thematically, and it'll give us a chance to show a lot more of the collection. And then the rock room will change slightly. We're going to add more dinosaur material in that room. And then there used to be, I'm told, there used to be a thing called the kissing booth in the geology room. It was a darkened room
Oh,
that
yes. Oh,
you
yes. Yes. Now that you mentioned it, okay.
may have heard, yeah.
Oh, I say nothing. I plead nothing. My mother might watch this show, so I say nothing.
So I was talking to a lot of people who'd been here for a while, and then people who've been coming in for decades about kind of things that were here that aren't here now that they would like to see again. And people kept bringing up the kissing booth. So we'll have a black booth area in the geology room where you can look at the luminescent rocks and nocturnal animals and things.
Okay. What's going to
And
happen to all
then
the taxidermy?
the taxidermy will move to the where the Fickenbaum Hall is now.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
going to become a large taxidermy space with two life-size dioramas, and
Ooh, that's different.
and then a video room you can walk into that'll be immersive with 360 video and audio for various environments that we can change. But it'll all be surrounded by taxidermy and art that's related to the animals on display.
No, I see a lot of museums going into those rooms that have the video, the 360 video. It seems to be something that a lot of museums are doing. Do you find the trends change for museums and curating exhibits? Is there sort of trends that happen?
There's been I guess since I started, really, this debate about technology within your exhibitions and museums, and it's something I've always kind of tried to avoid for the most part. I just find that it really distracts from the artwork and the objects on view. And so when we're redesigning the first floor, I wanted to make sure that there were as few computers and screens as possible. people had thought we would have some interactives here and there, and I said, well, no, why don't we have a hands-on thing that kids can play with and avoid the screens as much as possible. So it'll still have the feel of the Berkshire Museum, but it'll be updated to modern museum standards.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I do remember a little bit of the discussion, the community discussion about potential changes in the museum a couple of years back. And there was a sort of fear that it would not be something that we would recognize.
Right.
But in the same sense, there was also people who recognized the need for some sort of update and change. And how do you sort of balance that? Because you're right, there's some things that are just what we traditionally expect in a museum and the experience, and that one-on-one with something where you spend a moment really appreciating it for its own value, and the history that it brings and the story that it brings, and sort of that technology piece that's that people sort of live by. It's a real balance.
I think a lot of people were concerned about it becoming too technological or too flashy, and I guess I'm more old school. I wanted to kind of keep it, at the Berkshire Museum that people have come to love, but update it and make it more contemporary, I guess. Add LED lighting and update the flooring and the walls and everything, while keeping the essence of the Berkshire Museum. Like I said, the diorama room is not really changing at all. We're just kind of changing the lighting in the cases to LED lighting that
Oh,
can
nice.
change from dawn to dusk and things like that. And I guess the most important thing I forgot to mention was the little cinema, the
Oh,
center. So that will be converted into the new aquarium, which is currently in our
wow.
basement. So it'll be moved up into the center of the building, and it'll be expanded to more than twice its size. We'll have floor-to-ceiling tanks and new kinds of fish. We'll have jellyfish and more reptiles, and the fish and the animals will have a lot more space as well. It's really it'll be quite something.
It's quite a plan. How long did it take to put a plan like that in place, first of all, and making all those decisions? That must have been quite the conversation about what would go where and how it would all fit and
The aquarium, I think, had been talked about for several years about moving it because the space is in now. It's very, very popular, but it's kind of hidden away, and so they wanted to bring it out front. So that one's has been talked about for a while, and the other ones, really, when I started, the new director who started before me, Kimberly Bush-Tomeo, she really gave me a lot of creative freedom, I guess, to help decide what the first floor was going to look like. And so it was kind of a mutual idea to come up with these cabinets of curiosities, keep the diorama room, move the taxidermy, but make it more exciting, I guess, liven it up a little more.
So now, when you mentioned the cabinets of curiosity, of course, it makes me think, of course, of Mr. Crane. Do you contend, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the museum? Because I think sometimes we lose that.
Well, the museum opened. He built the museum here in Pittsfield in 1903, and at the time it was part of the Berkshire Athenaeum, and it was really, like I mentioned, he had this idea of kind of bringing the Smithsonian to the Berkshires, and so he sent people around the world to find objects and things, and that's really the basis of the collection. Things like the mummy and
Oh, yes, the mummy. I remember that.
That really formed the basis, and then the museum became its own entity in the 1930s, and separated from the Athenaeum. We still collaborate quite often, but the museum became its own institution. We had our first director, who was Laura Bragg. She created the Bragg boxes that travel to schools, and now we have them. We call them mobile museum units, MOMUs, and they travel all the time to schools around the Berkshires, and people love them. But she was the first female museum director in the country, and moved here and became our first director.
That's interesting. I don't think I didn't know that piece of history. That's interesting.
It's just gone through a number of changes since then. you know, there was we had Stuart Henry as the director from I think 1939 to 1978.
Wow.
So yeah, quite
A
a
long
long time.
tenure.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
And yeah, so he was here for a while and really put his stamp on things and did a lot of more of contemporary collecting. And then yeah, the last 40 years, I guess, has been just co collecting more contemporary art, but also collecting some older objects that people give to us and things.
Does the museum still, I don't know, do you purchase, you still accumulate new pieces? And how does that work for a museum, particularly since I'm assuming you have sort of space constraints?
Yeah, we have very tight space constraints. Yeah, because the collection is so massive.
Oh
I can imagine. I think we have something like 20,000 seashells, you know, so
my goodness.
it takes up some space.
Yeah.
So yeah, we actually get quite a few gift offers from people. They'll offer paintings or objects to us, and many times they're really wonderful pieces that we'll accept. And that's generally kind of how we're building the collection now. There are, you know, smaller pieces that we find along the way that we'll pick up, but not doing so much collecting right now. We're really focusing on rebuilding the museum.
So what's the timeline for all those changes at the museum? Because it sounds pretty, pretty extensive.
Yeah. So it'll start in, well, it's scheduled to start in mid-September, and it will happen in phases. So the museum won't be closed or anything. We'll have just part of the first floor closed at a time as each section is done. And it's due to be completed by the end of 2025.
Oh, wow. Well, there'll be a
So.
big celebration.
Oh, yeah. No, it'll be a really amazing time.
Yeah, it will be. I just now, so as far as doing all that work, is it done in-house or do you have a contracting company that kind of does these things for museums? How does that work?
Yeah, we're working with some local companies,
Okay.
Skanska and Bradley, to
Okay.
help kind of coordinate things. We just hired a contractor, Tierney, to help coordinate things locally and hire subcontractors and
All right.
everything. And we've got Yo Hakamura from Studio How in Los Angeles, who you know did the new design and everything. And it's really a wonderful design. And yeah, we've got a lot of local people working on the logistics for everything.
That's terrific, but I'm sure they're not going to be carrying all those exhibit pieces at the end. I get that's your is that your bellywick to kind of set it all up? It's like, when the house is done and someone comes in and sets up the furniture. Are you kind of the furniture setter upper?
Well, yeah, and you imagine all the taxidermy we have. I mean, that all
Oh,
has to be packed up and
yeah,
put
right.
away. And yeah, that's
It's gonna
quite a
be,
bit.
yeah. So you must have to really orchestrate this.
Yeah, we've already started working on it and
Yeah.
returning some loans to people that we've had out and things, and figuring out what's going to go into storage and how we're going to store things, because there is quite a bit on display that we need to find a spot
Find a
for.
home for it. That's, I mean, it's just gonna be so amazing. I mean, just to kind of watch. I think it'd be interesting to come in and kind of every couple of months sort of see how it's progressing and moving along. I think that would be really
Sure.
interesting, actually.
Yeah.
For me. But in the middle of all of this, you're still doing exhibits
Yes.
and you're still having activities in the middle of all of this.
Yep.
That's a lot. So I know that you were doing the 120th anniversary series.
Yep.
Can we talk a little bit about that? Because I think that was really kind of fascinating, actually.
Sure. Yeah. They've been planning it when I started here last April. And the idea was to do one show on the 120 years in two galleries. And I just suggested breaking it up into three separate parts because I thought trying to pack 120 years into two galleries was a little tight. And then I said too, we get three times the audience because people will come back. We get three times the press,
That's
hopefully. So, but then it's been great. So we've had room to cover each period. So the first part covers 1903 through Laura Bragg's directorship. The second part was then through Stuart Henry's tenure through 1978. And then the last part that just opened is 1979 to 2024.
And how's that being received?
Quite well, yeah. No, we had a number of press people here at the opening, and Yeah, they had some really great questions. They noticed that there weren't so many objects out. There was a lot more art on the walls, and that's because during the period, it wasn't like 1903 when we had all these amazing objects from around the world. It was more contemporary art collecting and things. So it looked quite a bit different than the first 120th show.
When did that sort of shift happen for the museum? From the curiosities and really items of interest, antiquities coming in, to sort of the shift to art, which is really, I mean, we are known for our art, and obviously that's always been a discussion in the community.
I guess it started at the end of Laura Bragg's tenure. She started looking more into contemporary art, and then Stuart Henry really focused on that. And so it moved I guess from collecting objects really to more focusing on artwork, but also still collecting objects, but really looking at contemporary art. And quite a nice collection. Everyone's surprised to see we've got a Keith Haring barking dog painting on the wall
That's
upstairs.
right. That's right. Yeah, there are. Are there any favorite pieces that no matter what, it has to stay out?
Oh boy. Well, the mummy, I mean,
Oh, the absolutely. We all know about the mummy.
Ah, geez. There are so many wonderful pieces. I love the icons that we have. Some tapestries that are being conserved because they're very, very fragile. So those I hope to have out soon. The cuneiform tablets, I just love those because it's just, they're so wonderful. But just, I don't know. So there's so many great pieces.
There are. Well, I can tell you. So I'll share a quick story. We're going to be at the top of the hour in just a moment, but I'm going to share you a quick story. So I was a young girl, and I'm trying to pick out the year, but then again, if I say the year, I probably don't want to say the year. But I remember two field trips to the museum. One was, of course, the mummy, which everybody remembers. And it was really what triggered my interest in ancient civilizations and cultures. So I ended up at college majoring in cultural anthropology. And the second one was there was a tea room. And if I remember correctly, it was at the, well, I remember as a kid, it was sort of at the top of the museum. Like it was up a flight of stairs. So it must have been upstairs in the gallery upstairs. And they had to set up like a Japanese tea room or Chinese tea room. And I remember sitting on the floor having tea. I don't know when it was. I don't know. I thought maybe someday I'll come in there and see if we can research the year. But it
That's
really,
interesting.
I mean, I'm several decades older than that now. But it's, it sticks with me. And I think, the museum and experiences there do stick with people. And you mentioning the kissing booth, I just had a memory about that too, but we won't talk about that either. We're at the top of the hour, folks. And we're going to have a few messages from our underwriters who absolutely make all of this possible here on WTBR 89.7 FM, Pittsfield's Community Radio. But I will be right back in a few moments. So we'll continue our conversation with Jesse Kowalski. He is the chief curator here at the Berkshire Museum. If you missed the first half, you might want to catch it on pittsfieldtv.org because it's been a great conversation about the museum and just how things get done there. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jesse.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs. Greylock Federal, opportunity grows here, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
Support for closed captioning on PCTV is brought to you by the Feigenbaum Foundation, with additional support from the Pittsfield Commission on Disabilities.
Still paying for that monthly gym membership? How about that streaming service you never watch? Why not support WTBR-FM instead? For just $8.97 a month, you can show your support for our community radio station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click donate. It's as easy as that. We need to support this station to keep it on the air, and every little bit helps. WTBR-FM, for the love of radio.
This is Kevin Cahill from the Sunday Sounds of Ireland show, which you can listen to every Sunday on WTBR 89.7 at 10 a.m. You will hear the jigs, you will hear the reels, the fiddles, the bowrons, and the bagpipes, Paddy Riley, the Wolf Tones, the Chieftains, and even some cranberries. So listen to the Sunday Sounds of Ireland every Sunday at 10 a.m. here at WTBR 89.7.
Do you have a favorite show on WTBR-FM? Did you miss the last episode? We've got good news for you. Most of our shows are now available on podcast. You can subscribe to your favorite and have the latest episode downloaded to your device automatically on Apple, Google, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or Overcast. Go to WTBRFM.com/podcasting and find out more today. WTBRFM, for the love of radio.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBRFM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Hello, everyone, and I'm back. You are listening to Morning Drive right here at 89.7 FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. If you're just joining us, we've just had a great first half. We've been talking to Jesse Kowalski. He is the chief curator here at Berkshire Museum. If you're still with us, I hope you enjoyed the first half, and we have a lot more to cover. So we've been talking quite a bit, actually, about putting all the exhibits together, how the exhibits come to be, a little bit about the history, and some changes that people can look forward to, and upgrades and changes at the museum. But I'd like to go back, if we could, talk about some of the current exhibits. So you do have one, the Painted Pages. Would you like to share more about that?
Yeah, it's the exhibition on illuminated manuscripts that were created between the 13th and 18th centuries. Mm-hmm. Illuminated manuscripts is something I really looked into when I was doing the fantasy exhibition at the Norman Rockwell Museum, because a lot of them will have different fantasy creatures drawn on the sides. And the Reading Public Museum have this traveling exhibition of their illuminated manuscripts. And I actually worked with the curator 2009, I believe, on an Andy Warhol exhibition. So it was nice to reconnect with him. And we had the show. It opened, I think, just 2 weeks ago, and it's been pretty popular. It's a really interesting show.
Now, the manuscripts, something that was in the current collection, or did you have to borrow those pieces?
Yeah, those are all borrowed from the Reading Public Museum in Reading, PA.
So how does that work? I've always found that interesting. I'll go to a museum and it'll say unloaned from. And I'm thinking, uh-huh. how does that all happen? Like, is there a big catalog somewhere that you all know what each other have? Or how does that kind of happen? It's like borrowing sugar from your neighbor. Like, how does that happen?
There's a secret society of curators.
There you go. There must be.
No, I don't know. There's different channels you can find out about exhibitions that are available for rent. And yeah, that one just really struck me as something I thought would be interesting and really neat to have at the Berkshire Museum.
Yeah, so I think it's one of those exhibits that really captures the essence, the origin of our museum and what mm-hmm. we, I think what we do well. Do you agree with that? And I think, you know, it's something that maybe young people would not be exposed to if it wasn't for sure. museums, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So it's
yeah,
great. No,
yeah, there's a lot I didn't know about, you know, the first manuscripts were from 400 AD. Illuminated manuscripts really started around 800, 900 AD, but they were printed on calf skin. And some of these books would take up to 250 calves to make the pages for all the book,
wow.
just one book. So it was just phenomenal. And then these monks started out, they were just copying pages. Each page had to be copied from another page by hand. And then you had someone who would pencil the letters, then someone who would ink the letters, and then you pass it on to a person who would apply the gold leaf or silver leaf, and then someone else would do the painting on top of that.
And how are these books preserved all this time? I mean, it sounds like it's pretty fragile.
Yes, they're very fragile.
Yeah, right?
A lot of these are just pages taken from books because the person they got their collection from, he had a number of illuminated manuscripts, and he broke them up to sell them to museums and private collections. Mm-hmm. There was some controversy there, but he felt that it was better for people to at least own part of an illuminated manuscript than not yeah. own one at all. And the only way that they could do that was, getting it piece by piece, I guess. So a lot of these are just pages on their own. There are some books in the cases, though. Yeah, they're it's really fascinating. Some of them are, I think, 6 inches tall. There's others that are almost 3 feet tall. So,
It's so interesting. Now, would this be a kind of exhibit that would travel? Like, once you put an exhibit together, does it then travel? Do you share ideas and say, here's my, I did all the work, folks. You get to do the exhibit now somewhere else.
It really depends on the show, I guess, and how popular you think it would be at other museums. And you always have to gauge interest from colleagues, I guess, on exhibitions. Like when I was doing the fantasy exhibition, I had worked with several museums, and so I had contacted a few, and two museums ended up taking it and did very well for them. And so they've asked about other exhibits I'm working on. So, yeah, you just try to build a reputation and rapport with other colleagues, and that's how you sell them, I guess.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating career to me. I mean, it's just, I think when people go into a museum and you see it, it's almost like, it's not like setting up your house, folks, where you dust your curio and you put in, your Hummel collection that you've been collecting, right? There's so much more thought and things go into it, like even just the research to make sure it's accurate, then having the right items and finding items. And then how long does the exhibit usually, I mean, once you put all that work into it, how long does it usually, the average exhibit, time wise, what's the average exhibit time, lifeline, I guess, or lifespan?
From when you start working on it, or
Yeah.
it really depends on the size, I suppose. I try to plan 3 years or more in advance for the
Oh,
exhibitions, but
wow.
really start working on them 2 to 2.5 years in advance. For the larger ones, the smaller ones don't take quite so long. You could do those in under a year, but the bigger ones, you want to do them right. And usually a lot of writing involved because sometimes there's catalogs, but you want to do extended labels and things, and you'd have to borrow from several different collections, and that takes time to request from different collectors and find the right pieces and things. And then you get everything here, and you might have to frame some things, prepare some things, and then hang it on the wall, and it's up for about 2.5 months.
Oh my
And
goodness.
then it either comes down and goes back home, or it can travel to different venues. So it's
It's a lot of
there are
work.
several people, really everyone in the museum is somehow involved in each exhibition.
It's pretty exciting, but I know after all that work, it hangs for a couple months and then you're on to the next thing because really it is also about getting people to come back to the museum to see what else you have up. So yeah, I guess there is a certain life interest, I guess, in an exhibit. So,
Yeah, it's a little, I guess it's a little sad, once a show
yeah.
opens, but you make new relationships, you meet new people, and work with them on other projects. So
That's true.
it's always expanding.
But no, it really is. It's pretty fascinating. And to be in the process of putting an exhibit up and knowing you're also planning for the next one at the same time, I mean, it's kind of like running and walking at
Well,
the same time.
actually, planning for a few at
Yeah, right.
the
So
same
you
time.
have one coming from June, September, which I'm hoping you'll be back on with me again to talk a little bit more about the wild indoors, which you had mentioned was the animal art of Julie Bell, which I think will be really interesting for the Berkshires. I think that's a real interesting one.
People might know her husband better than her. His name is Boris Vallejo. He was one of the top fantasy artists from the 70s and 80s and 90s. Some of his more famous works are the poster for National Lampoon's Vacation with Chevy Chase standing on the mountain or whatever.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he did a lot of album covers, a lot of calendars, things like that. And Julie Bell was a nationally ranked bodybuilder in the 80s. And she met Boris at one of her competitions, and he asked if she would model for him. And she began modeling for him, and they fell in love, got married. And she went back to doing some illustration that she had done after college, and became the first woman to draw Conan the Barbarian for Marvel Comics. I think she was the first woman to have a cover of Heavy Metal magazine,
Wow.
did video game covers, and now I think in some ways her career has kind of eclipsed Boris's, and she's doing really well, and now is doing these animal paintings that are really qu quite impressive.
No, it sounds really interesting. And it's interesting as you were talking, of course, I'm thinking to myself, what a great exhibit for kids and teens and young adults to come into our museum and to really bring them into it. Because I think sometimes, I don't know if kids are as interested in museums as to me, I would go every weekend. I was just fascinated. Yeah. But with all the other sort of entertainment competition that's out there, that's a little bit, I don't know, more stimulating, I guess. I don't know what the right word is, whatever. This is kind of exhibit that I think would bring in would bring in young people. Don't you agree?
Yeah. And, she's known mostly for fantasy art, and the paintings are just depictions of animals. But
Yeah, I think kids would absolutely love it.
Fantasy look to them somewhat. So while they are, I think people really enjoy the paintings.
I think so too. And I think it goes to the conversation we had in the first half about the life of a museum and how it has to kind of keep its foundation and its origin, but also sort of morph a little bit to capture audiences as audiences change and culture changes and society changes.
Yeah. Yeah. On that note, we'll get a little more serious here, but I'm working on an exhibition on the Holocaust for next spring.
Wow.
I began speaking with the Jewish Federation here last summer about doing an exhibit, and it was really spurred because I was reading in the newspaper about different schools in the area, swastikas being drawn on the walls and things, and one school where a teacher had to leave because he was Jewish and was being harassed by a student, and then there was a poll that came out at the end of last year that showed that 20% of 18 to 29-year-olds don't believe that the Holocaust actually happened, which is really shocking.
It is. That totally is crazy.
Yeah, and then another 30% aren't sure. So, so I felt it was really important to do a show on the Holocaust and really show younger people what happened and what it was like. And it's really, I'm really hoping students come to see it, and I'm including a number of paintings and drawings that some children did at a concentration camp. It's called Theresienstadt, and the Nazis kind of built this camp up as the ideal camp and kind of to show the Red Cross they were taking care of the Jews, and made it this ideal camp and everything. And as soon as the Red Cross came, they got rid of everyone. But the teacher saved about 4,000 paintings and drawings that these kids had done.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so to have, 12-year-olds here seeing drawings on the wall that 12-year-old kids had done, I hope gives some context to the today's youth, on what these people were going through. We'll also cover history, kind of to show that, Hitler and anti-Semitism didn't just happen overnight, that it's centuries-long developments, and also show some of the science behind, how do you get a country to back something like this? And there was a psychologist who did some experiments, Stanley Milgram, and he showed that if you've got someone wearing a lab coat instructing someone to deliver shocks to another person, then you could get about 60% to deliver fatal or near fatal shocks.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that really supported the whole idea of, the Holocaust and everything, and getting people to support it. And so we'll actually have some of the straps that Stanley Milgram used in those experiments on display to really kind of bring that home about, how people can get involved in those things.
I can see that exhibit attracting people from outside our community.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and we're working with the local schools because I'd really like it to be part of the part of the plan curriculum for next year for all the schools to come and see the show. And I think it'll be very, very educational. My hope is we get as many people to see it as possible.
Do you still have a lot of school groups that come through the museum? Is that still?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Tons of groups, yeah.
I'll tell you, it was the best field trip ever. I'm telling you, it was actually the best field trip. But that exhibit, actually, I'm so grateful to you for putting that exhibit together. I think that goes to show that the museum, shows its, you know, shows its collection, does, you know, the art pieces, but this is really a gift, I think, to our young people and really to our community, that we're doing something like that.
Yeah, I've got two teenage children, and, you know, it's, I hear stories from them about school and the way kids talk about things like the Holocaust, and it just really bothered me. Yeah. And so it's spurred me to start getting involved in this exhibition. So
you mentioned your teenage children. So what do they think of the work that you do?
They don't think it's as cool as I think they should think it is.
Right?
But in the Tony DiGiulizzi exhibit, I did put a unicorn on the wall. And when my daughter was about 5 years old, she always said she wanted me to create an exhibition with unicorns.
Oh, there you go. So now we know.
Yeah, she was proud of me during that moment anyway. So.
But do you ever, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know, how old are your children?
16 and 17.
So I think about that age group. And of course, you know, our lives are about technology. Mm-hmm. How do you see artificial intelligence affecting museums and curating? And do you see there being any kind of, you know, concerns or possibilities?
Oh, boy.
That's a big one, right?
That's a huge topic online. Yeah. Many, many artists are very upset about the use of AI in creating art, because a lot of it is stealing images that they've created and that are available online. And then people can knowingly or unknowingly use those images to create another piece of artwork.
Wow.
And so it's really about, you know, their copyright just being completely taken away without their knowledge. And the AI art is not something that someone's really creating themselves anyway. It's kind of, they put in commands or whatever, and then out comes this piece. And so a lot of artists I've spoken with are just adamant against that. And I know there have been some art competitions where they've allowed AI art, and they've been very controversial. Mm. And we're doing our Art of the Hills exhibition this fall, where we open it up to people in Berkshire County to submit artwork for this juried festival. And I, for the first time, I'm including AI art will not be allowed.
Wow. Yeah. So is it hard to detect when it is AI art? I mean, is that something that we're going to worry about in the future?
Not right now. I think it's still in its early phases. So you can, it's pretty easy to tell, I think, when something's not, because, you know, a lot of the features are not quite right or whatever. Yeah.
What about an exhibit, a technology-based, you know, I mean, like a history of technology? Because mm-hmm. I'm thinking even through my whole, like, at what point is something museum worthy? Is it time that does it? Is it its cultural significance? What makes something museum worthy?
Yeah, I think it's both of those. Yeah.
Like my back cell phone from the 1970s.
Oh, boy.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, there are a few exhibits I've been thinking about, but one is about the history of video games. And
that'd be fun.
Yeah, the history of those, but also the art that was used on the cases and in the product packaging. But just the process that went through from, you know, Pong, mm-hmm. all the way through today's VR and everything. It's a phenomenal history. And I think it, you know, definitely something that will bring the kids in.
But I think that's an interesting history all around too, because it's funny because I'm actually putting together a presentation that I'm doing at a local library. And one of the things they asked me to do was sort of the history of games and how they help, you know, keep the brain stimulated and the mm-hmm. growth of the brain. And it's been just to research that little piece has been really fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's just been researching, like, you know, backgammon and cribbage and mahjong and chess and all kind of those games that we play every day.
Yeah.
And just getting back to the history. So I'm totally enthralled with this project. So I can't even imagine how enjoyable your life must be. You could research this all the time.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, and that's half the fun, is doing research on these things and reading about them and kind of, you know, devising how would I display this? How would I get this message across, whatever.
So do you have to be an artist to do all of this? Because it's a pretty creative pursuit, what you do.
Yeah, actually, no. I think me being an awful artist is what really helped me become a curator. I don't really know any curators who are good artists. I think that we're failed artists, and this is our shot at being in an
And
exhibition.
that's right. Yeah, because I always wonder that, like, especially to put something together with a lot of art pieces. Like, do you think of yourself as sort of an art critic, or just a sort of appreciate the history of something, the collection of
I think
something?
more of a fan, yeah, because
Yeah.
I'll go to different festivals or conferences with different artists, and I'm just in awe of a lot of these artists, and meeting Julie Bell and Boris Vallejo for the first time was just, I had a Boris Vallejo puzzle when I was a little kid in the
Oh.
early 80s, and so yeah, it was something else. But yeah, no, really being in awe of a lot of these people and the work that they've done.
Yeah. So when you go on vacation, do you go to museums?
No.
Oh my God. I had to ask. I said, you must just like constantly be in museums, but
Like if you work at Pizza Hut, you don't want to go out and have pizza,
well, isn't that's probably true, right? That's so true. I didn't think about it that way. That isn't probably entirely true. Because I'm like, oh my God, I'd be going through it going, I wouldn't have done that. I would, yeah, maybe
Yeah, it gets that way
there's a
sometimes.
little of that too, I bet, right? With
Yeah.
anything, right? There's a little bit of that. So we only have a couple minutes left, so I do want to do a recap for folks who are just joining us. We've been talking about the Berkshire Museum. And just a fascinating life of a curator, I guess, is what I'm going to call this show, because that's really what it's been. But you do have a couple exhibits currently. So if you don't mind taking a moment just to kind of go through those and the date so people know.
Sure. Yeah, we have illuminated manuscripts exhibition right now from 13th to 18th centuries. I've got to check my calendar here.
Okay.
And the 120th anniversary, the third part of that. So that's February 3rd is when those open, and they are open through May 5th. And then the summer shows, Julie Bell opens June 1st, I believe. And that'll run through the summer, and then in the fall we'll have Art of the Hills. And just today we're starting our 10 days of play,
Oh, good.
our biggest week of the year. All the kids come, so we've got 3 days of this big bubble bonanza that kids love. So on the 19th and 20th and 21st, from 2 to 3, we'll have the big bubble show. We'll have the Wingmasters people who have the owls. They do this lovely program that'll be on February 25th. And then we are having a 10 by 10 jazz festival on February 24th at 7:30 p.m.
Now that sounds fascinating. So, are you doing that in conjunction with someone, the Jazz Festival?
Yeah, that's in conjunction with the 10 by 10
Have I done?
exhibition group. Yeah.
So, where can people find out about all these events and what's happening?
Yeah, you can go to our Facebook page or check out berkshiremuseum.org.
Okay, and it's all there. Everything's there. And then, of course, coming into 2025, people need to mark their calendars because on February 1st, you're starting The Light and the Darkness. Stories from the Holocaust. When we were talking about that, I want to ask you a quick question because have you been to the Holocaust Museum in the city?
No, I haven't actually.
All
No.
right. Yeah, because I was there in the city a couple times, and every time I went to go, the line was just like so long and I just couldn't get into it. But when you did this exhibit, is it most of the things that we had in our collection or things that you borrowed? Was there anything in our collection?
Yes, mostly things borrowing. Yeah.
And
Yeah,
what did
there's some collectors around who are very happy that I'm doing the exhibition, and they put me in touch with other people, and so yeah, there's been a great network of people who are willing to help with the exhibit.
So I have to ask, I know it's, I'm not asking you to commit, but what else is on those 50 idea sheets? What are the ideas you have brewing?
Oh boy.
Don't commit now. This is not a commitment, folks. So don't write into them and say.
Yeah, well, the fantasy show I did was very popular, and so I plan to follow that up with a sci-fi show. There are so many artists I'd love to work with. Video game exhibition would be great. I'm doing an exhibition coming up with James Gurney, who did Dinotopia, and Thomas Kincaid. He's known as the painter of light.
The painter. Yeah, but the puzzle guy.
Yeah, but this is about their early years when they were really young. In 1980, they traveled by rail around the country and ended up writing a book on the Artist's Guide to Sketching that came out in 1982. That's being republished this year. And so it'll be showing their work from the early 1980s when they were doing different projects. They actually worked on a Frank Frazetta film, doing all the background paintings and everything. So that'll be another fun show.
Well, I'll tell you, Thomas Kincaid is really, really popular.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that because he's on every puzzle, right?
Yeah.
Every senior center I go to, there's a Thomas Kincaid puzzle somewhere. So that would be interesting. You're thinking about that in sort of mid-2025?
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about doing an exhibit just on the history of Pittsfield?
Yep.
I'm just going to put that out there. I always thought that would be kind of interesting. I think Pittsfield has an amazing, amazing history. And I always wondered what we sort of had for, you know, artifacts and things. I mean, I know we have our local library and our history department, but I always wonder, like, I don't know. I just thought it'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, in 2026, for the country's 250th anniversary, we're planning some exhibitions based around Pittsfield and Pittsfield's history.
So you're already thinking about 2026.
Oh, and beyond, yeah.
And beyond. See, so I did kind of get that out of you a little bit. Okay, I feel good about that. Wasn't planning on doing that, Gia, but I was really curious. I was really curious. I have so enjoyed our conversation today. It's just been really a lot of fun. I've learned a great deal about what it takes to do things at the museum, to put those exhibits together. And I really wanted people to sort of appreciate that it wasn't, you know, taking things out of a box and dusting it and kind of putting it up there and then doing, a 5-minute piece of research and, you know, gluing it on the wall and calling it a day. Like, there's just a lot of thought that goes into the exhibits and a lot of time and effort that goes into it.
Oh yeah. Yep.
And the other piece is to be watching for all the changes at the museum, which sound pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think people are really going to enjoy it.
Yeah. So what do you suggest for people to do? Come in every couple of months and check out what's happening?
Yeah. Things are always changing here. So, yeah.
Come in every couple of months. Make sure you get there at least next weekend, school vacation. So you're probably going to be crazy busy in there.
Yeah.
Right.
If you got kids, come on down. If you don't, maybe wait a week.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least get to the jazz concert, right?
Yeah, sure.
At least get to the jazz concert. So there's something for absolutely everyone there at the museum. Thank you again, Jesse, so much. Hopefully I'll have you on again and we can talk a little bit more about the exhibits coming up and just constantly learning a little bit about what's happening at the Berkshire Museum.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for being with me. And thank you absolutely everyone for listening today. I hope you enjoyed this morning drive here at 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield Community Radio. I've enjoyed being with you. And if you have not caught the entire show, you can do so by going to pittsfieldtv.org and you can catch all of the morning drive shows. So if something sparked your interest, but you didn't catch the whole show, make sure to grab the show there at your leisure at pittsfieldtv.org. Or don't forget, you can always go to Pittsfield Select, download the app on any of your smartphone or devices, and you will have PCTV with you all the time. Well, folks, this is the end of the hour. Thank you so much for being with me. Looking forward to being with you again. Before I see you again, I want you to stay well, stay safe, and have fun, and make sure you get to the Berkshire Museum. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.